Okay, hi folks, and welcome to episode 38 of Starbase 66, your international Star Trek and science fiction podcast. And this week, we are incredibly honored again to have with us a very distinguished lady. Harrison Solo is a writer, a university lecturer, a strategic consultant and creative consultant. She's worked on over 400 different publications, written 5 books, is that right now?
Five is coming up.
Right, okay. I knew there was a 5 in there somewhere.
Yes.
She's working on her doctoral dissertation, and
yes.
You hope to get your PhD next year?
Yes, 2010, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you've taught at UC Berkeley, and you've lectured or spoken at Harvard?
Yes, well, it was a one-time lecture given at Harvard, yes.
Okay, and spent quite a few years in Wales and taught, or you were writer in residence at the Welsh Academy. Is that the right?
It was the University of Wales.
University of Wales.
Yes,
okay.
one of the campuses. It's like UC Berkeley. I mean, it's like UC where there's a lot of campuses. One's at Berkeley, one's at UCLA, and Wales has the same sort of system where there are a lot of campuses, but they're all called the University of Wales at particular thing. That's changing now, but that's how it was when I got there.
Okay. And also, you are the author of Gene Roddenberry, The Last Conversation, which we have spoken of many times on the show here. And in connection to our last show, you are also the wife of Herb Solo. And so we are so thrilled and honored and overjoyed to have you on the show. Welcome aboard.
Thank you, and it's a great pleasure for me, too.
Let's start with a little bit of your background, if you don't mind.
Okay. What do you want to know?
Well, I know that you started off as a nun, as a Franciscan nun, right?
Well, yes. I mean, not quite started off as. I mean, I had a life before that. But yes, I was, at a very young age, I did go into the Franciscan convent, and I was a Franciscan nun. I went there for a lot of reasons other than religious. I actually wasn't religiousness that sent me there. I just thought the whole concept of complete dedication to something, and in large part that was study and contemplation, was just a marvelous way to live, and I still think so.
Okay. Was it hard for you to leave, or had you always planned on not making it a career?
No, I didn't go in there with the idea of coming out. I don't think anybody does. I mean, I knew it could, but it was very hard, yes. I mean, I made intensely strong friendships there, and when you live in silence for a good part of the day, you learn other ways of communication that are, I don't know, body language perhaps, almost a kind of silent telepathy, just an awareness of another person in a way that you never have when you're talking all the time, and when there are other distracting noises, so that any bonds that you form are especially tender and especially intense. And so I did leave those, my friends and fellow sisters and colleagues, and it was very hard. The thing that was the hardest and the most surprising to me, I was pretty young and so pretty green. I had the protection of a habit. So in those days, at that time, in that place, I could be as friendly and as outgoing as I would wish, and the habit protected me. Everyone said, well, this is a nun, and so she's being, you know, friendly and kind, and there's no ulterior motive, and there's no troll overtone. But as soon as I left, and I was the same person, I behaved the same way, it was quite a different story, the way people react to you. And then I had to learn that lesson in a few hard ways, that you just can't be, you can't behave in as loving or as open a manner without a habit as you can with one.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I especially back then, now that I think about it, that's
well,
not...
It was actually the summer of love in San Francisco when I left. Well, it was still there, but it was going on after that. It was, you know, the 70s. So, yeah, it was, that was kind of a, a stupid thing not to have foreseen, but I was, again, very young and not particularly experienced at that time. So it was kind of a hard lesson to learn and not to be as open as one would like.
That's often a hard thing to find in any type of life when you move out of the shelter and discover that not everyone's going to be as accepting as the people you were around when you were younger. So,
well, although they weren't that particularly accepting, I mean, I did get in trouble a lot there in the convent, but it was a different kind of trouble. I mean, your motivations weren't questioned. Let's put it that way.
Right. Right.
Yes.
So literature played a big part in all of your life, really. I read that you learned to read at a very young age.
I did, and that's thanks to my mother. She used to buy these little golden books, they were, I think at the time they were 25 cents, and they were actually in the grocery store on the rack, and she would buy me these books. And then she started to take me to the library, and I kind of learned to read through reading those when I was really a toddler, really, or just under about four, maybe three or four. And I started to just fall in love with these little books, and then she took me to the library and I got my library card, and to this day, to me, heaven is a library. I love libraries. There's a great book called Reading Rooms, I think, and it's all about different places in the United States that are libraries and people's reaction to it. I mean, writers and public figures and their reactions to libraries, and it's just a wonderful book to read. I have it somewhere. I'm kind of looking at my bookshelf now and I can't see it, but that would describe my feeling entirely. That whole book is just full of accolades to the library and books, and that's really as far back as I can remember, a library has been my favorite place.
So you would relate to Samuel Cogley pretty well, I would imagine.
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness. I haven't thought of that name for a long time. Yes, I suppose I would. I think there was, Andrew Carnegie was not a very nice man, but I have to overlook everything he ever did for starting the free library system in the United States. I just bought a biography of Andrew Carnegie, and so I'm looking forward to reading. It's like, 2,000 pages long, but when I get a chance, I'd love to read it.
So after you left the convent, then you went to school.
I was going to university,
yeah,
during the convent.
Oh, okay.
Years from the time I started. It's very interesting when your first year you're called a postulant, and the professors from university are brought into the convent. There's classrooms and things, and you get the same education that you would if you went out. And the second year is called canonical year, and you take only those things like theology and philosophy that are pertinent to a spiritual life, and your day is mainly spent in silence and manual labor, and that sounds like breaking rocks. I don't mean that. I mean like cooking and cleaning and, anything that you can do with your hands, like chop wood, carry water, as the saying goes, that makes your mind clear. You don't study all that much. And then the third year, we went out to university, so we never stopped studying it. But after I left the convent, I continued to study. Yes, I did. I went to university as a secular person.
Now, the way you got the assignment to interview Gene Roddenberry, you were working for a publisher.
Yes, I was a special projects editor, which was a contract position, not a salaried employee position, at the University of California Press. I was also teaching at the time, so I was doing both things. At least some of the time, I was doing both things. And at the time, I my two sons, who are, just the light of my life. They were then, they still are. And they were watching this show called Star Trek, which I hadn't seen. I mean, I knew it existed, and we were one of the very few shows that they were allowed to watch in the convent, but I didn't really watch it. I'd seen part of it. I was always doing something else during recreation. But I saw it in syndication when my children started to watch it, and they were, enamored of it, very fascinated by it, and I didn't pay much attention to it. I was always doing something else, but they would be in the next room watching this. I'd keep an eye on them. And one day I heard this screeching, strange, weird noise coming from the television. So I went in there, and it was the episode, I think it's called A Private Little War. when they go down onto this planet and the, I guess it's the Klingons are escalating weapons on one side.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay. The private little war. And there was this woman in this fuzzy, you know, orange, greenish, pink, no, orange, pinkish bra struggling, and this guy was like in a slit her throat, and I'm thinking, oh my God, what are my kids watching? So I said, you turn off that television and go outside and play. This is not a good show for you to watch. And they said, Christopher said, it is, Mommy, it is. And I said, well, it certainly doesn't look like it to me, and I don't want you watching this kind of thing. And he said, very sensibly, well, why don't you sit down and watch it? And then you can see for yourself. So I did. And I actually realized what they were talking about and what the issues were and what my kids were thinking about and talking about as a result of it. And I was very, very impressed. So I started watching all of them. And I did watch every episode, and when it came time for what happened was I was working at the press editing scholarly material. Most academics are just terrible writers, by the way. I mean, they are absolutely horrible. The books that they put out are usually, well, heavily edited and rewritten by other people, and I was one of the people hired. I mean, it's not the thing that they're not clever. They're enormously clever, but they don't write. They're not writers. They're thinkers and researchers. This is with great exceptions, of course. I know people who are marvelous writers who are academics, but my job was to take, you know, badly written academic, you know, gobbledygook and turn it into a book. And so when I did these things, they were very pleased with me. They were very pleased with my writing, and I had written other things. And to make a long story short, they said, will you write a book for us? And I said, on what? And they said, well, we're doing a series called Portraits of the American Genius. At that time, it had a V in it. Portraits of the American Genius. And we would like you to write on someone who has really influenced, something that has really influenced American culture. And I thought, well, science fiction certainly has. And then I thought about this show that the kids were watching. And I said, can I do it on Star Trek? And they you know, practically fainted and said, no, we don't do television. And I said, but yeah, but it's really interesting. It's something that has influenced American culture. It really has, because by that time I'd made a huge study of it and found this whole underground of, you know, people that are like another species. And they were kind of against it. So I did a presentation, and they finally said, yeah, you know what, this is probably a really good idea. We should do something new like this. And so they said yes. And I wrote to Dean Roddenberry and told him what I had in mind, and he said, or what the press had in mind, and he said, yeah, he said, I was told, you know, he's not going to accept anybody doing anything, he's not talking to people, he's not interested, but he did, he wrote right back, or his secretary wrote right back and said, yes, he would be delighted to meet with him, would I come down, so I did.
So one of the things we try to do here on the show is kind of pull the veil away from things. All three of us at some point in our lives or another, pretty much revere Gene Roddenberry as an almost larger-than-life figure. And then, especially after Herb released his book, started to see a little more of what more the reality was like. And then as I was reading your book, we talked to Susie Plaxen. Do you know who she is?
I don't think so.
She played Kalar on Next Generation. Worf's mate. We had her on the show, and she got to meet Gene once, and she was just blown away by him. And she said her statement was he was made of light, and she was just totally enraptured by him. And it seems to me that he had a great charisma, because reading your book, it was very clear that he was a very, very powerful personality and a very charismatic person. Would that be an accurate description?
Yes. I would think that I would certainly think so. Now, you have to remember one thing, okay? I mean, this is really, it happens in everybody's life, and I don't see why it's so hard to apply it to a separate situation. But you may know somebody when they're 10 or 20, and someone else knows them when they're 40 or 50, and you know two different people. The first person may have excellent or horrible experiences, and the second person might have excellent or horrible experiences. And if you match, that's good. But if you don't match, you have an endless, you know, discussion about what the truth is. The truth is that people mellow and change, and Herb knew a very, very, very different Roddenberry than I did. And I don't say that Roddenberry, that Gene Roddenberry did change, you know, to the point of black and white, but he was certainly mellower when I met him. You know, young men are very different than old men.
Yeah.
And he was sick also. I have to say that he was always extremely courteous, very polite, very helpful and very kind to me. I have heard the opposite from any number of people, and I know the opposite to be true. I have absolute proof that it is true. And if you talk to, if you could get some of the people that who have had these experiences to talk to you about it, and you won't, and they won't, then you would have the proof that I have. But in one sense, it doesn't matter. My job was to write the person, to interview and to draw a portrait of the person that I saw, and not to do a biography in which all facts must be documented and be correct, and there'd be some sort of linear progression of personality development and facts and figures. There's also another thing that people don't like to hear, and that is that there's an inside and there's an outside. And 99% of the people that you interview, even if they're actors on the set, I mean, actors don't know producers. They think they do because they have meetings with them, or they have a few minutes here and there with them. But they don't know them. They don't stay in their houses. They don't go to their parties. They don't have dinner with them. They don't watch them fighting with their wife or disciplining their children or doing a deal that's shady or perhaps greedy. They don't see any vices. They don't see the entire personality. And I was able to see that, not only because I was there, you know, frequently and consistently and over a number of years, but because people who were married to him or were related to him or had been friends with him for 40 years or worked with him for, you know, 50 years or were his mother or his, you know, cousin would tell me these things and would show me pictures and would show me letters and would show me things. And so I know better. But you can't convince anybody of that. And I don't know that it's necessary anymore. I thought it was at one time. I don't know that it is. The man that I met, as I said, was extremely nice to me. At times, he certainly was not nice to other people, and I witnessed that. But he was always good to me. Well, and he adored his son, Rod, who I happen to think was a lovely little boy. He was a he wasn't a little boy, but he was a boy when I met him. And that is in his favor as well. I mean, I don't know exactly what you're asking, but I subsequent to the publication of the book, because I met Herb and for other reasons, I came into contact with and I entered a world beyond Star Trek, which is a much bigger world with much more important people, heads of studios and people with power and money, and to whom Star Trek was just a blip on the horizon, people who made, you know, blockbuster movies and people who did huge deals, not just one television show. And so in that context and from those people, I learned a lot more. And I felt obligated to not sound like such an idiot from my first book and do a revised edition, but it didn't go over very well, and I'm not surprised, actually. Nobody wants to hear that what they thought was one thing is actually another. I mean, people don't even like to go back to their hometown and find it changed, so it's not surprising.
Well, I think you summed it up quite beautifully in your book when you described him as having a ubiquitous capacity for metamorphosis. I think that's a perfect encapsulation of what you were just saying, how people change. They change through their life, and they also change according to who they're interacting with. And,
yeah,
you know,
right.
I think the way your book came out, I know that you say that there were dilemmas as you learned more about this man and that there were different facets to him. But I have to say that I had the honor of reading your book before I read Herb Solo and Rob Justman's book. And I think that those two books fit together in such a complementary way and provide such a wonderfully holistic view of Gene Roddenberry in all of his multifaceted dimensions, the nice side, the unnice side, the complex, the simple, the straightforward, the sly, the hidden. So I'm glad that the revisions that you had hoped for didn't necessarily come about, but that these two books fit together so beautifully the way they do.
Well, I'm not sure which book that you read. The University of California Press, the hardcover edition, is the original edition, and then there was a subsequent revised edition. It's not that all that revised,
yeah.
Actually. It's just I was trying to be a little bit more balanced because I just,
right.
You know, I was slightly criticized in some circles, particularly by very powerful people in Hollywood, for saying, you know, you didn't even say anything, you know, negative, nothing. And I said, you know, I got to tell you, I didn't experience much negative. So if I'm writing about my experience, that's it. But, you know, nobody likes that. You know, there was a very interesting thing that happened. I used to go to a lot of Star Trek conventions, and because of the book and prior to the book, because I was, you know, I went with Majel sometimes for research or just for fun. And afterwards, after Herb's book came out, people, you know, certain fans got very cross. Not sensible people, but, you know, certain fans. And one of them called me up and said, do you want to come to this, you know, speak at this convention? And I said, I don't know if I can. Let me see. Because I had a publicist who usually took care of those things while the book was, you know, for about 5 years, and then there was no reason to. So I said, let me see my schedule. And she said, by the way, you know, Herb can't go, Mr. Sobel can't go around saying those things that he said at the last convention that he went to. And I said, well, he certainly can. It's his show. You know, he hired Gene Roddenberry and everybody else on it. He's the only person who knows everything about its inception and about what happened. Nobody was there. Shatner wasn't there. Leonard wasn't there. I mean, you know, they just weren't there. There's nobody. Nobody can. They make things up afterwards because, I don't mean Shatner and whoever else I said. They're not making things up. It's just that a lot of things are hearsay and things become myths. And so she said, anyway, I said to her, you certainly can say that. It's his show. He can say anything he wants. And she said, I said, you know, I don't know what her name was, but you know, Mary, it is a truth. And she said, oh, no, we know that, but we just don't want to hear it. And I thought that was an absolutely perfect philosophical statement about fandom. They absolutely know that they're hanging on to something that's not true, and they just don't want the bubble burst.
Absolutely.
And so there was no reason for us to go then, because I'm not interested in anything that's not the truth, as I see it. You know, right. That's all truth is relative, obviously.
Well, that was something I wanted to ask you. I don't know if you've heard yet. It was I just read an article this afternoon that the Television Hall of Fame is inducting Gene Roddenberry coming up soon.
I didn't know that, no. But,
oh,
I mean,
okay.
I'm not surprised. My goodness, it's an iconic show.
Yeah.
Although they should really induct her because it was his doing, but
well,
anyway, it doesn't matter.
That's what I was wondering is, do you think that maybe Gene has become more symbol and less person over the years?
Oh, absolutely. Good heavens, absolutely. Yes, of course. He is a symbol. I mean, there again, with any hugely, you know, public figure, there are so many levels of knowing that person. When the president gives a speech, everybody praises him for it and claps and you know, shouts and all the rest of it, and he may have objected strongly to a particular passage that he gets the most fame for and the most credit for, and some, you know, White House staffer has just spent, you know, 7 hours wrangling over the inclusion of this particular passage, and it wasn't his idea to begin with at all, but the president says it in public, and so he's credited with it, and that's the same thing that happens. I mean, Gene's speeches were written by other people, they were researched by other people. I'm not saying he didn't believe them, and I'm not saying he didn't have any ideas of his own. Of course he did. But I know for a fact there are two sort of philosophical, well, I don't know what you'd call them, sort of tenets, let's say, that are attributable to him, and I know perfectly well who wrote them. And who created them and who thought them up and who had to persuade him to include them in them. That's not saying a negative thing about him. That's the way life is. Everybody learns from everybody else. What I dislike about fans is they have no idea how a television show works. They think Gene Roddenberry had an idea and he told the studio, I'm going to make this, and sits down and writes all the 79 episodes, hires everybody, and oversees everything and has every idea. And I was actually guilty of some of that before I got into Hollywood a little bit more and realized how things, that's not how things are done. As Herb probably told you, Gene came in with a piece of paper, one single sheet of paper with a red Spock who was evil and had a forked tail, and Herb said, hold it. this sounds like a great idea, but we have to work on this. And he spent 6 months working on it. Now, Herb never gets any credit for that, but he deserves it. Half the ideas are his, of the original ideas, and the rest of the shows are written by other people. Just look at him. I mean, talk to Harlan Ellison. You know what? If you can get Harlan Ellison on this show, you would be so lucky. I love Harlan. He is, well, he's not the easiest person in the world, and he knows it, so, you know, this can go on the air. But I just adore him, and he will tell you his side of the story about Sitting on the Edge of Forever. Maybe you've had him already. Have you had him on?
No, I'd love to. To be perfectly honest, I'm terrified of the thought of asking him. But,
well, I mean, I'm sure there's a website or something, but I suggest that you talk to Harlan. I mean, he's like, I could listen to him for hours. I have listened to him for hours, and I never get tired of it. So you'd be really fortunate to get him if he's not too busy or if he's in the mood or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, especially.
I haven't talked to him for a while, but I think it would be fun for you.
Well, especially in light of his recent victory over the rights on City on the Edge of Forever, because I know that he got, is royally screwed an appropriate term over that episode?
I would certainly say that's what his term is, I know the story behind that. I know what Gene actually told me. I actually have Gene saying it on tape. I have a lot of tapes, by the way, that people would be surprised to hear. I've just kept them in storage. I don't know what I'm going to do with them, but they were the tapes that I took when I was interviewing him, and some of them were just very sweet and some of them were very, very surprising. In any case, yes, Harlan was not treated well in that respect, and I think you'd be well to hear his story.
I'd love to. I've read his original script, and mm-hmm. It was amazing. It was, you know,
it is,
very
he's
different
an amazing
from what,
writer.
Yeah. Now, in the book, you mentioned at one point that, talking about the tapes, the things that didn't make it into the book, you said that there were a lot of things that he said, wait till 20 years after I'm dead.
Yes, 20 years from now is what he said, yes.
Yeah, are you planning to do anything with that? And if you don't want to answer that, that's cool, too.
No, I'm not planning on doing anything like that. I mean, I think, you know, I think Star Trek is a marvelous show. It's an extraordinary show. It's groundbreaking and it's fascinating. And I always think so highly of it. But I'm done with it. I mean, I'm really done with it. I am. You know what? I was watching Paul Newman looking at some old footage once of one of his movies. And he was looking at it. And he had his hand on his chin and he looked so intense. And the interviewer asked him, you know, I think she said something like, you seem to be lost in your own world there. What were you thinking? And he turned to her and he said, I was thinking, I don't even know who that person is. Mm. And it was a film of him about, 15 years earlier. And in that one respect, when I think about the Star Trek world that I was in and what I was doing, I don't even know who that person is, in the sense, it's not something I'm interested in now. In doing, I'm interested in it because it's part of my husband's life. It's certainly part of my life, but I'm not interested in doing. Certainly would never write another book on anyone else, actually. No way. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I'm writing a book which includes Timothy Evans, a wonderful tenor, but he's an entirely different person. I have his blessing and permission, and in any case, the book isn't about him. It's about the phenomenon in which he lives and how he became to be who he was, but so did a lot of other people. But I wouldn't actually ever sit down and write a biography, at least, you know, knock on wood. I don't know. I certainly don't plan to, no.
Okay, that's fair enough. Before we move on from Star Trek, because I certainly want to get into more things than that, would you mind, my favorite parts of the book, the last conversation, which I haven't finished yet on purpose, because I wanted to read the rest of it after speaking to you. I'm about three quarters of the way through it. Whenever Majel would come in and you'd give a few sentences to her, and I always found myself wishing you'd say more. Do you mind talking about her a little bit?
No, I don't mind talking about it. It's pretty sad. I mean, I don't mind talking about it. I loved her. I loved her with all my heart, and she loved me, and we were just such good friends, and everybody is so surprised. I mean, you know, people, I don't want to mention names, but people on the cast and crew of Star Trek, the original series, and Herb included, saying, you know, I just cannot see you and Majel being friends. How can you possibly be friends? And we are absolutely opposite in every way, and that's true. But I don't think that kind of matters, really. I mean, I don't want another person to, I don't want a me clone to be a friend with. I've already got me. I don't know what it was about her. She was poignant and needy at times, and funny and clever and outrageous, completely outrageous, and very ill, very badly behaved sometimes. And I could never be badly behaved, and I just would have liked to have been a little bit more badly behaved when I was younger. I don't know what it was. It was just chemistry, I guess. That's what she said. She used to say, this is just chemistry. And we lost contact because there were a few extremely jealous and little people that slightly came between us. We didn't quarrel, but there's just some not nice people in her circle, and you know, people I sort of detest and actually despise. And so after I married Herb and got into an entirely different Hollywood, those people were, of course, jealous, and I think that they had something to do with a slight estrangement. But she did used to call me sometimes after that. And I don't know what to say about it. What would you like to know? I don't know exactly what you want to know.
Well, just she's one of the people that we know very little about, and yet she was so important to the Star Trek universe. You know, our very first show for the Starbase was supposed to be a retrospective of the movies, but then she passed away like the weekend before we were set to record our first show, and so we made our first show a memorial to her.
That's
and
great.
And while I mean, all we really knew about her was what we saw on screen, and
well, I certainly didn't know her that way. I mean, I knew her extremely well. In fact, at one point, I think Rod, her son, and I were the only people that were given certain information, were given keys to certain rooms in the house, were allowed to go in certain rooms in the house. Other people were not. She had a couple of rooms that people didn't know about, and nothing sinister, obviously. but to just, you know, there's so public people have so many people coming into their lives and in their houses all the time, and she kept them. Mementos and memorial things, and she has some files and stuff, and I know that there are people who have done books who are allowed some files, but I certainly know they weren't allowed the stuff that I saw and read, and it was interesting. They think they were allowed everything, and they certainly were not. She was hidden. She was a very hidden person. I mean, she hidden in some respects, hidden to, I suppose, the public at large. But I think if you were a rabid fan and went to enough conventions where Majel was, you would have seen her certainly having a drink and talking. And, you know, I have to tell you something. People don't like to hear this either, and I'm sorry they don't like to hear it, but it's too bad. There's a huge difference between what is said and done in a person's home and in the green room, for example, than there is outside. I'm not saying people are hypocrites or liars, but just as you would in a family, you just don't give everybody your opinion about everything. I had a very unfortunate, although, is it, well, I shouldn't say unfortunate, I had a very strong disagreement in a civilized way, and it had made no difference to our friendship, with a writer recently who wrote an article about Star Trek, and he was absolutely wrong in about 10 things. And he said, well, so-and-so told him. And I said, yeah, but so-and-so didn't know. Because why would you ask this person, you know, he doesn't know. So you can't just put things down. You can put down that so-and-so said this, but you can't put it down as a fact. And I said to him, you know, you just don't know what happens in the car on the way to the event, in the suite after the event is over and we're all sitting there. I remember Michelle, who is Nichelle Nichols, who is actually extremely talented as a mimic and so funny. Majel and I were sitting, we had a suite and I forget where it was, actually. It might have been Oklahoma City. I can't remember. Some city. And Michelle came in, and she came into the room, and she asked Majel, because I was new to her. She said, is she okay? And Majel said, oh, yes, absolutely. So she came in, and she started to impersonate various people. I won't say who they were. And I can't tell you, I had a stomachache from laughing so hard. And it wasn't unkind. You know, we have to be things in context. I mean, she did, well, various people and various types of people. And I never laughed so hard in my life. But she would never do that if there were outsiders there. She wouldn't do it. And, you must be in situations, Rick, where you behave in a certain way. But you probably don't say things on the radio that you would say in your living room with your best buddy. So there's a lot that goes on, and there's a lot of knowledge that is kept quiet, not because it's bad, not because it's sinister, not because it's hurtful, but just because it's nobody's business, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So, people are pretty private, but I was very much a part of the non-private part. If you have a specific question about Majel, if I can answer it, I will. If I can't, I won't. I mean, no, not I won't, but I won't be able to.
Well, actually, I have a question about something that you wrote concerning Majel in the book. You had written that in your notes you had transcribed from a conversation that day. You had written in the border, if Gene is Star Trek, then Majel is Gene. Mm-hmm. And you wrote that you weren't really sure what you meant by that at the time. And I was wondering if now that time has passed, if you have any further thoughts on what you may have meant by that, or if you may have change that thought.
I do know what I meant by it now, and I have not changed it entirely. I'll do my best to describe it. Gene identified with Star Trek to the point in his later years, at least in the years that I knew him, by almost being a personification of the show to himself, not to other people, but to himself. He felt that the show was him and he was the show. Majel identified with Gene not as a producer of anything, not in a work way, but her identification with him was so strong that her life was subsumed, really, into his, so that life was absorbed by, her life was absorbed by Gene in great measure at the time. Now, he was sick and he was old and she was preoccupied with his health and his well-being, but he was her everything at the time when I first knew her. And mm-hmm. So her identification outside of Gene was tenuous at best with anything else. I think okay. That's what I meant. If it wasn't what I meant then, it's certainly what I see now. And looking at that statement again, I can't see any way to amend it.
Okay. And it almost seems like he was just as infatuated with her. You mentioned that it seemed like every time you asked him a question, he had one of three answers. It was either humanity, Majel, or Spock. And at one point you dubbed that his Holy Trinity.
Well, that's, again, I found the conversations with Gene fascinating, and I think that at the end of his life, and it was the end of his life, and I'm pretty sure he knew it was the end of his life, he was becoming a little bit more philosophical and identifying again with things that he thought were important to me or to the public at large or he would like to see in the book as memorializing him. I'm not sure that everything was entirely accurate. He did love Majel. He had a funny way of showing it at times, but he certainly did. There's no question about it. I mean, he is well known. He had lots and lots and lots of women. And I, for one, don't think that's a great way to show your love for your spouse, but you know, they had their own agreement and arrangement. I know that he was extremely dependent on her and wished her to think well of him towards the end. I've heard a number of other stories and anecdotes from extremely respectable people who have known them far longer than I and in younger years that were they're quite different, but this is what I saw. And as far as Spock's concerned, I think it's really strange. Leonard actually, I mean, Leonard created Spock. There's no question about it. There was a Spock character which Gene brought in, and Herb changed almost 180 degrees. But when Leonard took that part on, he became an artistic creator as an actor. And I mean, can you imagine Spock with a different face? I know we've just seen one in the movie that the kids made recently, the prequel. And I thought those guys were good. But if you're just, when you say the word Spock, the face and the word are the same thing. The thoughts and the word, the thoughts and the face, everything is the same thing. Leonard did that. He really did. I think to a degree that most actors are unable to do, but it's such a great part. And so because Spock was such an iconic figure and so well respected, and the writers wrote such good vocabulary and dialogue and background for Spock, that Gene also began to revere this kind of a character and decided to identify himself with it. Do you understand what I mean? I mean, when they were making the series, Herbie can tell you, there was no such identification between Gene Roddenberry and the Spock character. This is many years later when it had ripened and become something, you know, emblematic of American science fiction and television. And I would think that Gene, in an effort to make things meaningful to himself at that particular time, tended to identify more with such a deep character than he would have otherwise. And what was the other thing I said? Spock? Oh, humanity. Yes. One of his writers wrote a speech about humanity for him, based on his own ideas, of course, and everyone was very, very taken with it, and so he began to develop a relationship with that concept again towards the end of his life, much more strongly than he would have before. But it was. I know this speechwriter. I know who did it, and this is not to say that he didn't absolutely love it, and it wasn't based on some of his ideas, but again, he adopted it, incorporated it, so to identify with it, so that he would leave behind, I think, in this book, that I was writing something significant. That's my take on it now.
Now, you say that he presented different facets to different people. Do you think that the facet that he presented to you regarding his take on religion and humanism, you at one point told him that he deified humans rather than humanified deities. Do you think that that was him reacting to your past as part of the Catholic Church and as a former nun? Or do you think that those were really feelings that he harbored within but didn't necessarily have someone he could share them with until he interacted with you?
No, I think those were genuine. I think he had a genuine, that was, I think, pretty much 100% him. He just really despised organized religion, and I certainly can see why. I mean, I have to say here that if anybody's still thinking of me as a nun, it's not accurate. I have very different spiritual ideas, and I had pretty different ones then, too, but I actually love Judaism. Herb's Jewish, and I've been to a synagogue, and I've been part of the Jewish community for a long time, and I absolutely love it. But again, it's a culture and not a specific set of beliefs that attracts me, and certainly philosophy and a great intellectual tradition that I like. I mean, but in terms of how the Catholic Church has treated people over the centuries, I have no quarrel with Gene's dislike of organized religion. I was arguing with him because he was completely dismissive of it, and I was trying to say, well, look, you know, there. I mean, I forget who it was, the guy that directed the first, second Star Trek movie. I forget who he was, but he said the Mass was like a work of art. It's somewhere in the book. I forgot what I said about it, but it is. I mean, one of the things that happens when you've lived so many lives and you've been part of so many tribes and communities and all the rest of it is that you can relate an aspect of one world to another world. I could see parallels in Hollywood with the Convent, which I know sounds ridiculous, but I'm hoping to write an article about it. And, you know, indicate why it is not ridiculous. But I do think the dislike of religion was exaggerated for my benefit, but it was absolutely genuine.
Like how at one point he declares, "You're driving me crazy." I think you were comparing Star Trek to religion at that point.
Well, of course it's a religion. My God, have you seen these? I mean, have you? There are many degrees of fans. I remember talking to Mark Lenard for a long time once at some convention that we were. Conference that we were both at, and it is a religion. I mean, it's got its deities, it's got its commandments, it's got its what do you call it, golden rules and all the rest. Of course it's a religion.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so he didn't like that. Of course not. but it is up to some. It isn't to others, but it certainly is. There's a large enough component of people who adhere to it as though it were a religion to make that statement legitimate.
Yes.
Yeah, well, we've actually drawn that conclusion on the show before. We did a show about religion and science fiction. And
I love that. I love those two subjects.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
I love Asimov. Isaac Asimov, I love his, everything, his thoughts. He was just such a marvelous brain. And so was his wife, Janet, who was a close friend of mine. And when you get to the point where you're creating another world, at least when we were talking, I was talking to him or corresponding with him, he had to leave out religion because it no longer made to him sense in an evolved species. It doesn't mean that there's no spirituality. It just means that this willingness to surrender to very dubious history of subjugation doesn't fit in with an evolved species to most people I know.
Well, I always loved how Asimov, and I'm glad you brought him up. I was going to ask you about him next, and Clark too. They're two of my literary deities. In fact, Rendezvous with Rama was the first non-Star Trek science fiction book I ever read.
Really?
And it's still one of my all-time favorite books. I'll pull it out and read it every other year or so just because I love it so much. But I loved how Asimov, in the Foundation books, took religion and turned it into a tool for guiding the society. How he took the technical class and they became like the high priests of the equipment because they were the only ones that could maintain it.
Yes.
And then used that to guide the society.
It's actually quite medieval, really.
Yeah. Now, you knew both Clark and Asimov.
I knew them as correspondents. I actually never met either of them.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, it's really strange. I corresponded. Well, actually, Arthur C. Clarke. He was so funny. He got this what do you call video phone many 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 years ago, and he faxed me and said, "I've got a video phone now. We can talk, you know, face to face." And I said, "Yeah, you got a video phone. I don't have a video phone. You're like the only person in the world who had it." He said, "Yeah, but NASA gave it to me, or whoever gave it to him." And I said, "Yeah, well, they didn't give me one." So I have probably a forest worth of paper faxes from Arthur C. Clarke, and we were I don't know. This was pre internet, as you know, and so I don't know how I could, you know, how people can legitimately say somebody is their friend when they're not, but he used to call me his friend. He used to write to me all the time, and he used to send faxes all the time, and when emails came in, we had a huge email correspondence, and he would send me books, and we'd talk. So that way we were friends. Isaac Asimov was the same thing. We corresponded a little bit, not a little bit, but we corresponded, let's put it that way. And then he got very, very ill. Just after we started a marvelous conversation about mathematics, and I got to know Janet then, who I think is just so marvelous. You know, she's a medical doctor, she's a psychiatrist, she's a science fiction writer, she's just so intelligent and interesting, and I actually lost touch with her when I went to Wales a little bit, but I've got some stuff for her which I'm going to send, and I just absolutely adore her. She was friends with Arthur C. Clarke, and Arthur C. Clarke and Harlan and I and Janet Asimov were all friends. I don't know. I have a hard time using the word friends, but I don't know what other word to use when you know someone's thoughts so well, when they tell you things and you're close to them because they share themselves with you. I've got a friend who I've actually physically known. I met him in 1971, and we've been friends ever since. And we've only spent probably I don't know, after the first 2 years that we knew each other, our families knew each other, we probably only spent 3 days together in the last 35 years. But we write all the time, and we are friends. I don't know if physical presence is part of the definition of friendship. But yes, I would call those two my friends because they are, really, in my definition.
Well, does any of this sound familiar, folks?
I was just going to say, this is a subject that we've... The show came about because Karen and Kennedy and I met on an internet forum, the Simply Syndicated
Forum. Have you guys met
forum.
In person yet?
Karen and I have met, and Kennedy and Karen have met. We have not all three met yet. So the subject of the quote unquote imaginary friends is one that we relate to very much. There are a lot of people that listen to our show that we know through emails and through interactions through things like Twitter and stuff like that we've never met, and you know, there's a good chance probably never will, but we still consider them friends. So this is a phenomenon we can relate to.
Good. I'm glad you think so, because I think the friendship, it has to do with sharing. Having a common sort of, I don't know, soul, really, and sharing that with one another, and that certainly was the case with these two men, and I just valued their correspondence, their ideas, their trust, their confidentiality, so much. So they were friends. Carl and I actually know, have been in his house, have been in his playroom, have dinner with, gone to places with, and I just... you know, he's just, I don't know, I'd love to think of him as a friend, because he just, I'm certainly enormously loyal, and I think the world of him, and so, yeah, he's a real friend. We haven't been in touch for much. Once you go to Wales, you know, you're suddenly in a different planet, so it's pretty hard to do interplanetary communication.
Well, since you bring up Wales, I'd love to talk to you about your experience there. A lot of our listeners are in England. Which I know is
England
not Wales.
Isn't Wales.
I know. and I don't. Do we have any Welsh listeners? Or,
well, you will have, because as soon as you put the URL up, I'm going to send it to them.
Oh, please, yes, definitely. You know, it was reading Bendithian was very eye opening for me, because I don't know anything about Wales other than that it's down at the, you know, attached to England, and they've got the dragon and leeks. And
actually, England is attached to Wales.
Okay. but as I was reading that essay,
yes.
I realized that I don't know anything about Wales, and that I don't know if that makes any sense, but it was something of a revelation.
Yeah, not very many people do know a lot about Wales. I mean, that's one thing, actually, without joking around, that makes it very, very nice, because I was absolutely stunned by the life that I was leading there. I was living in a book. I was living, you know, decades ago. I was living in a society that I can't imagine living in the United States. I would walk home from, let's say, a choir practice or something from the university to my house, which actually admittedly was like 2.5 minutes. But if I went through the front part, I could walk past a pub of quite inebriated, large fellows, and I would walk right through them, and they'd move back and, you know, say hello or whatever, and I'd be on my merry way home at 11 o'clock at night. I mean, I grew up in Oakland and Berkeley and San Francisco, and I can tell you, there's no way in hell I would ever dream of walking through a group of, you know, inebriated males at that time of night on the street, on a dark street, and not that many streetlights, by the way. I could leave something. I could leave my purse open, you know, in the middle of the campus, and come back and find everything there. I can't even explain to you what this place is and was and is to me, because I couldn't imagine it before I went. And the people are extraordinary. The Welsh people, they're just magic people. I just adore them, with one or two exceptions. And they speak a magic language. They're connected in magic ways to the land and the past. Time has a different feeling. Do you know, in Welsh, the word for never and the word for always is exactly the same word? I mean, how science fiction is that? It's extraordinary. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful, and it's physically beautiful. It's the oldest continuously spoken language in Europe. Way, way precedes English. It's just a magic place. I just hope I can do it justice when I actually, you know, finish the entire book about it.
Well, I can't wait to read that one. I was loving reading the essay. Just you were talking when you were writing about talking to the women, trying to get some information out of them, and just yeah. their names: Bronwyn, Rhiannon, and Blodwyn. And
yes.
the one, the G W A R. I don't even want to try to pronounce that one.
It's Glaur.
Oh, okay.
Glaur.
But just that those names still exist and are
yes,
still being given
do.
To people is so awesome.
Yes, Angharad is the word. I think you were. I think maybe it wasn't Angharad. I think I changed her name because I thought it might be too hard for people to, you know, it just distracts when you're reading something and you see a bunch of consonants together and it stops you from the story. But I think one of them, the names was Angharad, which is Anghard. It's a beautiful name when it's said in Welsh, but if you say it in English, you know, as I would say it, or if I hadn't learned the language, I would say it. It doesn't sound very, you know, musical as it actually does.
Well, I was actually going to say... Oh, go ahead, Ken.
Go ahead, Karen. That's fine.
No, I was just going to say that I'm also looking forward to this book because the essay itself, which I think we should mention, was chosen from more than 8,000 entries to be published in the Pushcart Prize Anthology,
yes.
which was...
It was
quite
originally published in Agni, which is, I have to say, it's one of the best editorial experiences I've ever had. I have the greatest respect for Bill Pearson, Sven Burkhardt. You should look him up on Google because he's an extraordinary editor. I just had the best experience with that, and they actually made it better than it was. I mean, they didn't edit it heavily, but the editorial comments they made and so politely, so courteously, so, you know, gently questioning, is this all right? And when it was clearly better than what I'd just written, they it was just a wonderful experience. So Agni published it first. They're the ones that had the insight to take it, and then from the literary journals in America are chosen, or the editors nominate the essays or stories they think might have a chance to win a Pushcart Prize. And so that's what they did. So, yes, it was published in Agni first and Pushcart Anthology second.
And it, as we've said, it is an exquisite glimpse into Welsh life, and it's a beautiful piece about this gentleman, your postmaster, Timothy Evans. And
yes.
I know that you're working on a book that
yes,
will...
Yes, also called Vendisian. I mean, that's actually two chapters from the book. It works as an essay, but it's actually a piece of the book.
Okay. Well, actually, I have two questions. One is how are things coming along with Timothy Evans? I know that you speak about trying to introduce the world to his voice, and I was wondering if that was a successful endeavor thus far.
No, because yes and no. When Agni published, I should say yes first, and then I'll say no afterwards. So yes, when Agni published the essay, they actually had a marvelous idea and said, can we publish a little CD along with it? And I said, I don't know, you're going to have to ask, sign the publishers, I mean the music publishers. So they did, and we went back and forth. They burned a CD for Agni to conclude in the back of the journal. And so that was Timothy's recording debut into the American music scene. So that is a yes. The no part is that, you know, I'm an American, and to me that's a really good thing, like 80% of the time. The 20% of the time that it's not a good thing, which I understand having lived in Canada for 18 years and in the UK off and on for other years, is that we tend to be very enthusiastic and decide what's really would be really great. And it would be great if those people were Americans, but you can't treat other people like they are Americans. And so I can't, for the life of me, I was like pulling my hair out. I was like, how can this person, have you heard this man's voice?
Because I haven't. I tried to find sound clips online and I couldn't track any down.
After we're all finished with this, send me your address and I'll send you a CD.
Oh, thank you.
You can't even, there's no voice in the world like this. There's none. I mean, this is so pure and so exquisite that, well, you know what? I shouldn't oversell it because maybe you won't agree with me, but everyone else agrees with me. But the thing is that here I am there for like 2 or 3 years and say, you know what? You really have to come here. You've got to do this. This would be so good for you. I can't understand how anybody wouldn't want to share this extraordinary gift with the world. But in his mind, he is sharing it with the world because the world is Wales. That is the world. his right. animals, his fields, the town that he lives in, his relatives, his friends, and the Welsh people for whom he will travel a certain distance from home to sing in a concert or something, but not that far. And that's it. It's I'm in the book that I'm writing, Bendithian, I make a huge parallel to Horton Hears a Who. not the movie, which I haven't seen and I don't want to because it sounded terribly loud and terribly stupid, but the actual gentle book. And I'm kind of Horton in that sense, and I'm hearing this Who, and I'm saying, you know, come on out, listen, I'll protect you, I'll save you, I'll bring you to America and you can sing. And he's saying, you know what, I just want to live on my little clover leaf. So I don't think I was doing the right thing in trying to do it. I was doing the right thing and wishing for it. I wish everybody in the world could hear this, and if he could, if he was recorded, I think that would be great. If his records, not records, what are they, CDs, were available in the United States, that would be wonderful. But he, I don't think he'll come. You can't believe what an extraordinarily odd person he is. He's so sweet, and he's so different, and he's not like kind of a human person really. He's sort of like an alien person. Another little science fiction aspect of my life is Timothy, and he's just very, very different. You won't meet anybody like this person, so you can't treat him like another person. I used to get so cross at him sometimes because he just didn't behave in ways that one expects, you know, grown-up people to behave. But he right. But that is it. But I love that about him. I love that about him. I loved it about it then, but I didn't know it. And he's just a very, very different person. Well, you saw the things he says. Look at what odd things are those. He's so, he's so wonderful. You could write a whole philosophy based on Timothy Evans' remarks.
Well, you know something funny? When I was reading the essay, I wrote down in my notes here, it says Timothy Evans equals Michael Valentine Smith.
Michael Valentine Smith. Wait. Why does that sound familiar?
Stranger in a Strange Land?
Oh, right. Of course it does. Yes. My God, where's my head? Yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. Yes, you're absolutely right. Although I'm the stranger in a strange land, but he's emblematic of Wales and everything that one does not see about Wales and everything that you think you see about Wales. I can't tell you. I mean, I know I sound crazy, but I can't tell you what a different place this is. And people will go there and say, oh, no, it's not that different. I went to Wales, and I went to England, and I went to... And then when I was in England, I went to Cardiff, which is actually the capital of Wales. And they don't see it because they don't learn the language. They don't go into the rural areas where Welsh is mostly spoken. They don't listen. And they don't see with the right eyes. You have to see everything with the right eyes. And I just happen to have the right eyes for this particular thing. I'm sure if I went to some other place, I would be an absolutely hopeless visitor because I wouldn't see the real whatever it is. I mean, I you know, I can't imagine going to, I don't know, Chile or something and feeling the same way. But this is, I just hope you get to go there sometime, and I hope you call me before you go.
Well, it's very interesting that you talk about real eyes and things, because looking over your career and Herb's too, I can certainly see the serendipity between the two of you. You don't like to let myths unworthy myths live.
I don't think it's fair for people who work really hard and do things and write things for somebody else to get the credit. No, I don't. I think that's really wrong. So if the myth involves dissing someone else or severely curtailing their income or harming their career, then yes, of course I hate the myth. But I don't mind myths in general. I mean, they're the things we live by and learn by. If they're, you know, a fictional myth is much better than a half-fictional myth.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me tell you what inspired me to bring that up is I read your out of town visitor blog post.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that is so rude. It's true too. I didn't realize I was out, oh yeah, that's supposed to be publicly accessible, isn't it? Well, it's true. It's 100% true. In fact, it's 1,000% true. It happened exactly the way I said. So I'm sorry I interrupted you. What were you going to say?
No, that's okay. It's just. You were the first person I've ever heard defend Hollywood, and not just jump onto the "oh, Hollywood sucks" bandwagon. I mean, I'm guilty of it. We all are, you know, especially with the latest things that they've been putting out and taking classic movies and remaking them into crap and stuff. But you know, you just when your visitor just knee jerk poo pooed the quote unquote Hollywood machine or whatever, and you just totally set her straight on it. It was very eye opening. Again, you take the veil away. Like, you know, even in the Roddenberry book, even though there's some reverence there that, you know, may or may not have been a result of a glamour to, you know, of his personality, there's still, through it all, there's this thread of truth that I think really does show the real man. I don't think it was quite as flowery as maybe people gave you grief about. And I really love the way that you pull the veil aside and say, this is what's really going on, and look at it and don't be afraid of it.
Yeah, there was only a couple of people who gave me grief, and they had their own reasons for doing it. And believe me, it had nothing to do with what I was saying. It was largely jealousy. Although some people didn't like it at all. It was really funny, is that the people like the Smithsonian people and the NASA people and the people who people that are really prominent or high professionals liked it, and people that are actually like, I don't know, shopkeepers or things that we wouldn't normally consider to be a high powered job or high and live in a high power world, they liked it. The middle people, there's of those who didn't like it, and I didn't get a whole lot, but it was like sort of the middle, the two ends of the I guess professional spectrum or the social spectrum liked it. But yes, the point is, the thing about the Hollywood is that there's a very simple solution, and none of the blame lies at Hollywood's feet. It all lies at your feet and Karen's feet and Kennedy's feet and my feet. All you have to do is not buy a movie ticket or turn off the television. I mean, I can't tell you how fast the quality of movies would change, or the kind of movies that would change. It's the consumer that is responsible for everything. I mean, one guy makes a really crummy, you know, lousy, irresponsible movie, and there are people in Hollywood who would condemn that, and there were consumers who would condemn that. But 8 billion people go to see it.
Yeah.
So, and oh my God, so my studio is not going to close after all. I can save it by making this crap. Well, they do it. If it wasn't available, people would watch something else. They would. They did in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, so why wouldn't they now?
True. Of all of the things you've written, do you have, and I know this is a terribly classic interview question, but is there something you've written that if someone were to say, I know you're a writer and I want to read just one thing of yours, what would you suggest to people to read?
Well, I think it will probably be Bendición when it's finished. When the book, I know the essay is called Bendición, but the book is also called Bendición. But since it isn't finished, I would probably point them to Felicity and Barbara Pym, which is a book I just finished and is going to come out in May. And I really kind of like it. I mean, it does to academia what my other work does to Hollywood. And I'm not doing this on purpose. It just annoys me so much to see pretentious, not that bright academics parading around as, you know, really smart people when they're not. And I know so many smart people. So I take a little bit of a shot at academia without intending to. I didn't say, oh, let me see, how can I harm academia? Let me see, I'll write a book. I didn't. I was writing about an author called Barbara Pym, whose books I really, really enjoy. And in the writing of that book, I was advocating the application of appreciation to knowledge and not just deconstruction. And I think people do better to make literature meaningful when they try to appreciate it rather than when they try to dissect it. And so when I started to write about that, then some of the academics that I have known, and I have known marvelous ones and people that I respect and people that I care for, people that I'm grateful to, but I've also known some idiots, some real idiots. And I wouldn't want them teaching me or my children or anyone else. And I'm very protective of some of my students who have had very bad experiences with absolute nonsensical people. So it's a series of letters to a student, and it's telling the student, look, before you do anything, pick the people that you want to learn from, because you sure wouldn't want to learn, you know, boat building from a guy who'd never made a boat. So why do you want to learn writing from somebody who's never written a book?
Right.
Now, you know, anybody can take a hatchet to a work of art, but very few people can create it. Learn from the creators. That's what I'm trying to say in that book. And I like that book right now. I mean, maybe next year it'll be a different thing, but that's what I would point them to, I think.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that book. Is it necessary to have read Barbara Pym to be able to appreciate your book?
Only one or two chapters where it goes into specifics about characters in the book, but there I don't think so. No, it's really more about the value of reading, the value of literature, and the value of a literary education and the liberal arts than it is about any specific person. And it's also about how to approach the construction of your own life. I mean, so often, maybe not so much now, but so often in the past anyway, students would take as gospel what their professors say. And I know more than one student. In fact, I just wrote to one of my students, former students today, who was so badly damaged by one of her professors. I think you have to empower students a little bit, not to be argue for argument's sake, but to just say, you know what, this is your life. And you don't know as much as other people know in the field that you're trying to learn in, but you know yourself better. And you know if this is hurting you or harming you or disturbing you or whatever. So take a little bit of charge of your own life and choose the path that you want to take. Choose it well. So many decisions are made when we're too young to make them.
Yeah.
And so I want my students always to feel good about their education, not bad about it. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
That's a fantastic message. Oh, go ahead, Karen.
Oh, I was going to say, I love that attitude and that mindset for that particular book. I was an English major when I was in college, and it was due in large part due to the inspiration of a professor. And another professor almost made me completely change my major and drop English completely because he was such a horrible professor, and it was such a horrid experience. So I like the concept of this book as being letters to a student to encourage them and to support them in their choices. I also have to say I'm excited about the fact that I've read that Benedithian, the novel, is going to be an epistolary novel, which is sort of an underappreciated art form these days with the internet and email sort of taking over that form of communication.
Well, in the Barbara Pym book is also epistolary, and it is conducted via email because I don't think anyone would believe that a student and her professor would be conducting a letter correspondence. But it is simply letters, you know, pasted into an email. It's not email language. Alan Lightman, do you know Alan Lightman?
No.
This is another science fiction person. Well, he writes many things, but Einstein's Dreams, one of my favorite books in the whole universe, Einstein's Dreams by Alan Lightman. He teaches at MIT, I think. Anyway, and Einstein's Dreams is his book. He wrote another book, and in it, there is some email exchange, and it's in email language, which is appropriate for that book, you know, sort of syncopated and short and messagey. Mm-hmm. That would not be appropriate for this book. So it is letters, but those letters are sent electronically. You understand the difference. I mean, what I'm...
Yes.
Of course, you do understand the difference. Am I conveying this properly?
Absolutely,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
One thing that you said in the Roddenberry book, and it really struck me as something that I think a lot of people would appreciate if they heard it. You compared the original Star Trek to Greek theater. And that was such a powerful statement. It just kind of, I had to stop and think about that for a second. Because one of the biggest problems the younger generation has with the original show is the production values weren't the best. And you know, the acting.
Well, it was 1964.
Yeah.
When they started. So, I understand that perfectly.
But when you put it in that context, and it just, everything just sort of clicked. I mean, I love the original series. I've watched it since I was three. So there was no need for me to like it. But that statement right there gave me such a better appreciation of what the show was trying to do. And I just wanted to thank you for that.
Oh, well, Thank you. I mean, I can't really accept the thanks because it was completely unconscious, but I'm really glad you liked it. But the thing is that if you watch Doctor Who, I mean, I don't know if you do.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, if you're talking about production values, that's like probably the worst on the planet. I mean, I don't mean the current one, which is extraordinary. I mean, it's extraordinary production. But the old ones, which I prefer. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the monsters, they don't even have, they just have like dots, you know, made with an eyeliner pencil on their nose or something like that to make them aliens, and their teeth bend because they're like, you know, poorly rubber teeth for the aliens, and they just everything about it is so hokey, but it is such a great show.
Yeah.
It's such a great show, and I don't actually know if people who are young now can appreciate the show apart from the look of the show. Actually, I like the look of the show. I think it's grand. It's just so funny. I love their canine and those little squeaky squeaky things that don't work, and you know, just everything. I just love it. But it is, in one sense, it's like walking around in a toga with it holding up a mask on a stick. And that's all you need. I mean,
yeah.
That's all you need. It's really, it's the acting and the words. And the imagination, it's like radio. I mean, actually, if you just don't look at it, or if you miss some pretty significant interchanges of looks between people, but when you listen to a radio show, I mean, how fabulous is that? You can imagine everything.
Yeah, well,
so you don't really need the visuals. I mean, I know all my art director friends are just screaming over here. But in one sense, you know, the essence is, the essence is theater. That's what it is.
Absolutely. Just an aside, have you seen Torchwood?
Have I seen Torchwood? Yes. No, I haven't seen the whole series. I saw one episode, and then I came in the middle of it, just like I came in the middle of Mad Men. So I've got to go back and start from the beginning, because they both look absolutely fascinating. One of my sons watches Mad Men all the time and says, you know, you have to watch this show. And I know I have friends and I have students who watch Torchwood and love it. I've got to go back and do it. I'm just so over busy at the moment. I just don't know when I'm gonna get the time to watch all this stuff. But it is on the list. Why did you ask? You have a reason, obviously.
Yeah, because it's set in Wales.
Oh yes, of course. yes, but then you know, it's actually Cardiff, isn't it? It's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the rural countryside.
Right.
It's not the episode I saw. So there's not much telling about Wales. I mean, Wales is. I've got some pictures on my. You thought you read Out of Town Visitor?
Mm-hmm.
The only place you could have got it is on the Red Room, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So on the Red Room, and that same on my same site, there's some pictures of Wales. I think it's called the images, and that's what I mean when I say Wales. That's what I mean. You should see some of those things. They're just extraordinary.
Well, Harrison, thank you so much for giving us such...
You're very, very welcome. I've had a very good time.
You have so many different websites and things out there for people to look at. Is there one place that you'd like people to go to see your books and things?
Yeah, the Red Room. I'd say the Red Room.
Okay. And when Bendithian comes out and Felicity and Barbara Pym is coming out soon.
Yes, May.
Let us know. Send us an email and we'll put up a link to so folks can take a look at it and buy it.
Cool. Thank you very much. It's pretty far removed from science fiction, but I'll be delighted if you want to put the link up. That's great.
Well, we have a very, very wide and varied audience. And from what I've read of your work so far, I'm just enraptured with your writing. So I think if I like it, other people will too. So,
well, you're hoping, huh?
But anyway, thank you very much. And it was a joy speaking with you. And we are very honored and grateful. Thank you.
Well, the pleasure was mine, seriously. And I will actually now go and listen to Herb's interview, which I haven't heard yet. And thank you for that, too. Hopefully I suppose I don't want to say the cliche, but I do hope you will prosper. Because I think it's a really good thing that you're doing here.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And we look forward to your next project.
Okay. Thanks, Rick.
Thanks a lot.
And Karen and Kennedy.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.